Today's podcast is brought to you by Howie's new book, Paperboy. To order today, go to HowieCarshow.com and click on store.
Better strap yourself in. It's time for the Howie Car Show.
Some of you complain that I don't take enough of your questions. No comment.
Ha ha ha, Ernie, ha ha.
The problem is people are always going to compare your first term to Obama's. But I think there are actually a lot of positive similarities. Obama got us out of a recession. You got us out of a pandemic. Obama got bin Laden. You got OJ.
That wasn't so bad.
What are you talking about? I bombed.
You had some good stuff. The cancer bit.
Live from the Matthews Brothers Studios.
This has been coming since the 1960s. The people that were burning down college campuses, those people are now in the Faculty Senate trying to encourage these students to do the same.
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
Rump swabs, hacks, and moon bats beware. It's Howie Carr.
Welcome to the Howie Carr Show. I am Aaron Chadbourne, sitting in for Howie as he travels back from Florida. He'll be back with us tomorrow, but I am here. You might know me from WGAN up in Portland, Maine. I was former senior policy advisor to Governor Paula Page and thrilled to be with you here on the Howie Carr Show. Many of you have been following along the Karen Reed saga. The trial's just gotten underway today. Howie and Grace have talked about it extensively. And someone that's been at the center of it all has been Aidan Kearney, a.k.a. Turtle Boy, who was in court today for the first day of the trial for opening statements and as they started hearing witnesses. And joining us now to break it down for us is Turtle Boy.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, what a first day. For people that haven't seen all the coverage today, Aidan, can you just kind of give us a sense of everything that went down in that courtroom and how it played out?
Well, there's this term that the kids are using these days called epic fail, and that is basically what happened to the Commonwealth today. It was their turn to go first, and, you know, they get to, you know, pull the first punch. And every punch they tried to pull ended up helping the defense. And it's very clear that, I mean, we knew that they were going into this as heavy underdogs, but we underestimated just how incompetent they are and how little they have and what a disaster this is going to be. So both sides got to do their opening statements. The Commonwealth got up there and they basically bored the Adam Lally did what he always does. He bored people to death for 45 minutes. He talked about things that aren't relevant to anything, about what bars people are at, names of random people of no particular significance. Didn't really talk about any of the witnesses, because there are no witnesses, because nobody saw anything in this case. And then the defense got up there and were very convincing, and they explained to the jury that this was actually a cover-up, that Karen Reed's actually been framed for murder here. And we heard some new tidbits that we'd never heard before, particularly that lead detective Michael Proctor went through Karen Reed's phone without any permission and was searching for naked pictures for her, that he texted a friend of his in Tennessee, and he said to him that he hoped that Karen Reed killed herself, which would be very convenient to him because then there would be no trial and he would never be a household name at this point. He also said when asked a question, it was going to be a problem for Brian Albert because a cop was found dead on his front lawn. He said, no, he's a Boston police officer. He's got nothing to worry about.
And for those of you who haven't been following the Karen Reed trial, this, of course, is the trial where Karen Reed is standing trial for killing her boyfriend, who was a Boston police officer. Prosecutors are saying she hit him with a car and left him outside to die. But none of the facts in the case seem to add up. It's one of those kind of true crimes playing out in real life. And we're watching it. And now, I don't know, Aidan, you've been in many trials before, several courtrooms, maybe none where it's affected you so personally, given your involvement in this whole saga. You probably could see the reactions of the jury. You could see the credibility of the people they started calling to the stand and some of the evidence.
I was not inside.
Oh, sure. So from what you were able to observe, though, how does this compare to other trials you've seen?
Well, I wasn't able to observe anything because I wasn't inside. I was just able to watch on TV like everyone else. But I've never seen a case like this in which a prosecutor gets up with less enthusiasm than Adam Lally. I mean, I believe in Tyron Reed's innocence 1,000%. I could have gotten up there and made a much more convincing case than he ever could. This guy talks in monotone voice. He should be selling insurance instead of trying to convict people of murder because he's so bad at it. He probably couldn't even do that. He should be a librarian or something. And he gets up there, and I could have gotten up there and said, you know, at least been theatrical about it a little bit and said, this woman over here is going to try to tell you that this was all a frame job, but it's just she's wrong, and you're going to see the facts come out. He didn't do anything like that. He just got up there and literally put the jury to sleep. I felt so bad for them that they had to listen to this man talk. Then they brought up three witnesses. They brought up Paul O'Keefe, John's brother. They brought up Erin O'Keefe, who's Paul's wife, and they brought up Officer Saraf, the first person to show up. They showed Officer Saraf's body dash cam video, which shows Tyron Reed in a state of panic and hysteria, as one would if they were just to come across the body of their boyfriend and they were surprised by it. Also in the dash cam footage is Jennifer McCabe, the person who Googled how long to die in cold at 2:27 a.m., and she is cold, cool, and collected. She has her full hooded jacket on, and she doesn't look at John's body once, not once. Instead, she finds every officer that comes up to the scene and immediately engages them in conversation, because that is what manipulative cold people do. She wanted to basically be able to control the narrative, speak to the police first, and that is exactly what she did. That's why she was up at 4:53 in the morning after a night of drinking, because she wanted to be there when the body was discovered.
No, it really gives you appreciation for the role that body cams and dash cams play, especially when everyone's story doesn't quite add up. You can't argue with a moving picture.
No, you can't. And there's going to be a lot of that. They have nothing, man. They got nothing. They showed Paul O'Keefe shoveling snow. That was what they had today. I mean, he's got good posture. I'll give him that. But I don't understand what they tried to prove today. That Paul O'Keefe and Erin O'Keefe both said great things about Tyron Reed, that she was a really good, kind of stepmother figure to these children, to John's two children, that she bought them things, that they liked her, that both Paul and Erin liked her. There was almost nothing negative whatsoever that you heard today. So I'm not exactly sure what their plan was, if they're sabotaging this on purpose. If they are, well played. Because all we've been hearing for the last, year or so from the McAlbert supporters, of which there are very few, is that, oh, wait till trial. The bombshells are coming at trial. Well, the trial's here. And the only bombshell today came from the defense. So I don't think it's coming.
No, it's interesting. You're listening to The Howie Carr Show. I'm Aaron Chadbourne, sitting in for Howie. We're talking to Aiden Kearney, a.k.a. Turtle Boy, about the Karen Reed case. I think, Aiden, that a lot of people were expecting that this trial was going to be drawn out. It was going to take a lot of time. There was going to be a lot of fighting over procedure and admissibility. But from what I'm hearing from you and the press coverage I've seen so far, things are seeming to move at a pretty fast clip.
Oh, no, quite the opposite. This is going to take forever. They got through three witnesses today. You should have seen the questions they were asking Paul O'Keefe. I mean, talk about a waste of time. They're asking him about, none of it had to do with the murder, like nothing. They could have done the Paul O'Keefe interview in 10 minutes. He had almost no relevant questions to answer. They talked about, how long has John been a cop? What does John do for work? They asked every single person, what does John do for work? We know he's a Boston cop. So they are drawing this thing out, and it was so ineffective that the defense didn't even bother cross-examining Erin or Paul O'Keefe because he didn't say anything damaging to their client.
So you think their strategy here for the prosecution, other than intentionally losing the case, they must be trying to win, though. So do you think they're just trying to confuse the jury with too many extraneous details?
I've said this from the beginning. They don't care if Karen Reed's convicted. It doesn't. They'll probably sleep better at night if Karen Reed's acquitted. The whole purpose of this trial is to avoid putting the actual killers on trial, because that way they can throw their hands up in the air and say, well, we gave it a shot. She pulled an OJ. She pulled a Casey Anthony. We did our best. They don't care. This is a dog and pony show. The purpose of this is not to convict or even acquit Tyron Reed. The purpose of this is to prevent the Commonwealth from convicting, or at least trying to convict, Ryan Albert, Colin Albert, Jennifer McCabe, Brian Higgins, and the rest of the people who murdered John O'Keefe.
So when people go to watch the upcoming trial, what are you going to be watching for? And what would you suggest people keep their eyes open for?
Oh, just watch these witnesses. Watch all the Commonwealth witnesses. Listen to the testimony of Lucky Loughran, the plow driver. Listen to the testimony of Ryan Nagel and the two other people who were in the truck with them, who were sat outside of 34 Fairview Road and didn't see John inside Karen Reed's car or outside the car. Listen to the lies that the defense, that the prosecution witnesses like Jennifer McCabe, Michael Proctor, Brian Albert, Colin Albert, Chris Albert, that they all get caught in one after another. It is going to be the most entertaining trial in the history of Law and Order.
And people, of course, I know you're blogging about it, Turtle Boy. Where can they follow it?
TVDailyNews.com. I'll be doing a daily write-up of the day's followings. And I also will be live tweeting it on Twitter at Dr. Turtle Boy, D-O-C-O-R, Turtle Boy, because if Jill Biden's a doctor, then so am I. I will also be doing a show every Tuesday and Thursday on our YouTube channel, Turtle Boy Live, recapping the events of the week.
Well, I know a lot of people are following it closely. They appreciate you joining us to update us. And I know Howie and Grace are going to keep having you back. Turtle Boy, thanks for being with us here today on the Howie Carr Show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Doing a great job filling in.
Well, it's big shoes to fill, but someone's got to do it. Howie's off today. I'm Aaron Chadbourne filling in. This is the Howie Carr Show.
The Howie Carr Show returns after this. He's Howie Carr.
Welcome back to the Howie Carr Show. I am Aaron Chadbourne, sitting in for Howie. Thanks for being with us. Am I the only one who cared about the fact that DeSantis was meeting with Trump? Because I think it's interesting. I like the political theater. I've said this whole time, though, that everyone who tried to cover the Republican presidential primary as if it were a normal year and a normal primary, they missed it. Like, that's not what this was. What we have is the incumbent Republican nominee running again against the incumbent Democrat president. So it's basically two incumbent presidents facing each other. So just like you didn't see an open primary on the Democrat side, I don't even remember the guy's name, the congressman that tried to run against him, kind of in New Hampshire a little bit, Dean something. Spent a lot of money for no
Phillips,
reason.
Was it?
Dean Phillips. Yeah, I think that was it. But that's the thing, right? Like, he's some nobody that you've never heard of before. And so to think that it was going to be different on the Republican side, you have the incumbent Republican nominee running again. So I referred to it this entire time as make-believe presidential cosplay that went on and played out. That being said, going into that season, Ron DeSantis enjoyed a big stature with Republicans. A lot of people liked the way he handled himself during COVID. Florida stayed open and they've appreciated his leadership in Florida. And so I think it's interesting to see if he and Trump can get along and how that relationship will build and unfold, if he'll help the president with his campaign and see how that turns out. And that's inspired today's poll question, which is brought to you by Raycon. And Raycon, just in time for Mother's Day, if you've been worrying about what you're going to get for your mom, for your wife, for that special mother in your life, help that mom tune out all the noise on Mother's Day with a brand new pair of Raycon Everyday Earbuds. She'll get audio quality that she'll love at a price that you'll love even more. Right now, get 20% off plus free shipping at buyraycon.com/Howie. For the last time today, Taylor, what is the poll question and what are the results thus far?
Today's poll question, which you can still vote in at HowieCarshow.com, is would you like to see Trump offer DeSantis a position in the Trump administration? Yes, as vice president. Yes, as a cabinet member. No, embarrass him with the Mitt Romney 2016 treatment. Or no, but be nice about it.
So here's the text I got from my friend Carolyn. She says, those of us who spend a lot of time in Florida, we don't want to lose DeSantis as governor, which I think is no, but be nice about it. Having said that, she thinks he would be great for Homeland Security or Attorney General. He would definitely clean up the house of the Justice Department. So I think, you know, I'm torn between those yes team in the cabinet, no, but keep him out. I think let's let DeSantis stay outside Washington.
38% say no, but be nice about it. 35% say yes, keep him as a cabinet member. 25% say VP. 2% say give him the Mitt Romney treatment.
That 2%, you know. It's a vicious 2%. I'll never get that image out of, and you know what it was, I think, when Mitt Romney met with Donald Trump for that, was it steak dinner that they had? When they met in 2016 for Romney to beg Trump to have him be Secretary of State or some nonsense, someone compared him to Reek from Game of Thrones. I've never got that out of my mind. Like, I can't unsee it. And that embarrassing supplication of Mitt Romney to Donald Trump, who he now, he voted to impeach him, right? So, I mean, that's Mitt Romney. That's what you got. But anyway, I think the one thing about no, but be nice to him being the leading category, though, still 60% of people in our poll question did say they'd like to see him end up either as vice president or in the cabinet. So 60% would like to see him join the Trump administration. It says that there are a lot of people who still respect DeSantis, despite the fact that Trump saw it as a bit of a failure. Well, he failed the loyalty test, I guess, but he wasn't loyal because he challenged him after Trump had helped him so much. So I think people would like to see them stopping to compete and maybe work together, get on the same page. Might be nice. I want to do a quick wellness check with you, Taylor, on Columbia University. I know we had the protesters. There was a 2 p.m. deadline that came and went. I'm seeing on Twitter now that they had said to students, you have until 2 p.m. and then we're going to start suspending you. And now they're saying they've started the suspensions.
Yeah, I haven't found out much. Looks like the president, Manoush Shafiq, put out a statement a couple of hours ago and said she respected both sides of the argument, which was an interesting
way
of looking
that
at it. Sure. But it doesn't look like the students are backing down at all.
And she's not backing in either, though. And she said she's not going to divest from Israel or whatever it is that they were asking for her to do. But they're starting to at least suspend them. I think that, but then they say pending investigation, which means they'll reinstate them later. But I do think that there should be consequences. And Grace talked about this earlier on her show, but you can do things. You can take away privileges and rights. You can kick them off campus. You can take away their student housing. You can take away their access to libraries or to campus facilities or to the internet. Or you can just say they're no longer eligible to graduate in good standing. There are a lot of ways in which you can enforce your code of conduct, because if they're going to have a negative impact on everyone else that's worked hard, that's in there. And one of the texters earlier mentioned this, that, you know, for these universities that are canceling their in-person commencements, their graduation ceremonies, that's a big blow to local businesses that put up with all the nonsense of being in a college town all year long, thinking they're going to have a big event. They're going to make some money when people are going out to dinner, buying gifts, all of that stuff. It's a blow to the economy, too. So and from a lot of people that had nothing to do with the subject of these protests, which is peace in the Middle East. Like, I don't know. I don't know what the protesters are trying to affect, but I certainly don't think it's effective. All right. When we come back in the 6:30 segment, we're going to be talking to Austin Terrio. He is a member of the state legislature here in Maine. He's also seeking the nomination to take on Jared Golden for Congress. He'll break that down. Former NASCAR driver, which I do like the idea of a contrast. Young NASCAR driver against Jared Golden. He's from Aroostook County, the most rural county in Maine. One that has gone very strong for President Trump, was very strong for Governor LePage. And I think a lot of people would like to see Maine's second congressional district. I know I'm biased because I'm from Maine, but that's the one congressional district in New England that we have a chance at winning. Bruce Poliquin did it, and then it had it yanked away from him unfairly through ranked choice voting. So it's the one that we certainly have a chance to potentially win back. We talked earlier in the program to Mike Sobolewski, and so when we come back, we'll be joined by Austin Terrio so that we can get that side. Then we'll take more of your calls, 844-500-4242. I'm Aaron Chadbourne, and this is The Howie Carr Show.
Live from the Matthews Brothers Studios.
Matthews Brothers, coincidentally, another great Maine company. They make a great window, Taylor. So there are great things produced in Maine.
I never thought that was in dispute.
It wasn't. I think it's worth repeating. You know, I'm representing the state of Maine here. My name is Aaron Chadbourne, filling in for Howie Carr today. Also originally a Mainer. So we've got some great stuff going on in the Howie Carr, brought to you by the wonderful state of Maine. Also from Maine is our next guest who joins us right now, Austin Terrio. He is a state representative. He comes from Aroostook County, and he is running for Congress. He's trying to replace Jared Golden, one of two men who's running for the Republican nomination. Austin, welcome to the Howie Carr Show.
Hey, it's great to be on this evening. Hope you guys are doing well.
So, Representative Terrio, I know you were at the state convention over the weekend, and that's always a good, I think, way to get your finger on the pulse of what's going on among party activists, party faithful. What were some of the key takeaways you took from what you heard interacting with your fellow Republicans over the weekend up in Augusta?
Well, it's a good question. We were on the debate stage, and one of the questions that was asked was, you know, what's one of the first things that you want to accomplish when you get down to D.C.? And my answer was really easy. I said, we need to address the border. That's the number one issue. If you ask Americans, if you ask Mainers, people focus a lot on the southern border, but we have a large border. You know, I grew up in Fort Kent, and you know, Canada's right across the border, and we're seeing apprehension skyrocket. We're seeing people come across. We don't know who they are. And it's putting our country in danger, and it's really it's putting our sovereignty on the line. I mean, what country realistically doesn't have a secure border, and we're going against the rule of law. Biden's just not been there. He's not led on this issue, and unfortunately, you look at Golden, and he's not led on this issue either. Right when Trump was president, he voted against a lot of the Trump policies that would have helped secure the border, and now he's saying that we need to secure the border. But unfortunately, that's like fixing the barn door after the horses have left. You know, it's unacceptable.
No, I think it's a good point. I think a lot of people were disappointed. They thought it was great for the Republicans to hold their ground and demand that any foreign aid bill that were to pass Congress would have to in some way address the border. First, they demanded all of H.R. 2, but they never seemed to get their hands around asking for something specific. If you had been in Congress most recently when Speaker Johnson brought those funding packages to the floor, would you have supported the foreign aid without some sort of border funding, or what would you have demanded in order to support it?
No, I wouldn't have. I really feel strongly that we have to secure our country first. And I understand, like, there's some national security ramifications of what's going on in Europe. And because of the weakness with Biden on the world stage, I mean, you've got all these bad actors that are starting to act up and starting to realize that if they're going to make their move, they need to make it now. And that's what we've seen ever since Biden was president. But from a moral standpoint, I really think, you know, as somebody who puts their hand on the U.S. Constitution, that really comes first. And so we have a lot of work to do. You know, that's one of the things that I think the next Congress is going to have to handle, because it doesn't seem like right now anything regarding border security is going to be brought through and signed by the president. I think there's too many people that disagree that the border is an issue. Regardless of what they say, they're just not willing to act on it. So when President Trump is elected, he's going to need those folks down in Washington, D.C. And, you know, part of the reason he endorsed my campaign was he knows that we're going to be tough on the border. I come from a border state. It's not the southern border, but it's the northern border. And we share some of the same problems.
Well, I think it's interesting. You know, I worked for Governor LePage when he was governor, and there were a lot of Republicans who ran saying we need a strong Republican governor. And then when LePage got into office, many of them weren't willing to make the hard decisions or take the votes that were unpopular because they heard from the special interests. They heard from all of these, you know, the unions or whatever. You know, for people that say you don't have a political track record other than a one term in the legislature, what could people point to and look to say that you'll actually be a secure vote for President Trump and his agenda?
Well, it's a good question. I actually think that that's a positive attribute. You look at people who have political experience, and time in and time out, they failed us. I've, you know, run my own small business since I was 16, and I share the story of my grandfather. You know, he was like the first entrepreneur in the family, and then my dad took over the business, and we've been successful up in Aroostook County. But at the end of the day, you know, we need business people that are going to be in Congress. We need people that are representing our interests, whether it's Augusta or D.C., people that can balance budgets, people that can, you know, understand tax policy. All of these important issues that'll determine the success of our country, whether it's inflation and whatnot. I just don't think that these non-business folks who sometimes just come right out of college and go off and get involved in politics, I really don't think they understand what it takes. So the diversity is important. You know, I come from a business background. And I'm also a part of a generation that I think is going to be left with the debt, the national debt, you know, $35 trillion. We're going to have to address these issues. I believe very strongly we need to cut spending. We need to make serious inroads with that, because otherwise, we're going to default on the debt, and I don't see any coming back from that. So we have to make some tough decisions. And when Trump is president, I believe he's going to be in the position to be able to do that. And nobody else at this point, Biden or anybody else, is willing to make those tough decisions. And he's proved it. He's proved it when he was president. They came after him for 4 years, but he still got a lot done. And could you imagine if we were able to work together what we could accomplish?
One of the things that happened at the main Republican convention over the weekend was an amendment to the party platform called the Defend the Guard Amendment. I think Eric Brakey put it forward. And it basically said that Maine shouldn't allow the National Guard to be deployed to any conflict that hasn't been authorized by Congress. Just interested in your take on that amendment. And I know it was before the legislature earlier this session. Could you just explain a little bit about that and your position on it?
Yeah, it's a good question. Eric is absolutely the expert on it. I did sign on to it, to the amendment, and I also supported the bill. I believe at the end of the day that when our sons and daughters are being asked to get involved in foreign wars, that Congress needs to have the ability to take oversight on those issues. And we haven't seen Congress declare war, I mean, certainly since I've been alive, and it's been a lot. It's been many decades even before that. And I feel like Congress is sort of abdicated its responsibility in the Constitution for having oversight on the armed forces. Obviously, the president has a fair amount of ability to call the armed forces to battle and whatnot, but Congress does also have that responsibility. And I think it's time, even at the national level, we look at some sort of legislation to make sure that we follow the Constitution. And when our sons and daughters are called into battle, that Congress declares war.
Switching gears a little bit, Representative, you have a background as a stock car race driver, which I think a lot of people find unique and exciting. But that brings us to the question of, you know, where the country is going when it comes to the ability to buy cars and some of these mandates that are coming down in California from the Biden administration. From the failed attempt from Janet Mills and her allies to require all the cars sold be electric vehicles. How do we fight back against the federal government trying to take more control about what you can and can't drive, what you can and can't buy?
Well, we saw in Maine what happens when people from around the state get really aggravated with government, running out of control. And when the EV mandate was proposed, I mean, I heard from Democrats and independents who are generally a little bit more liberal on certain issues. They're like, absolutely, there's no way we're going to let the government tell us what kind of cars we have to purchase. And so I saw people from across the political spectrum get involved and kill that mandate. But by no means is that going away. I think environmentalists are going to continue to push that agenda. And what's most frustrating to me, as you mentioned, I have a motorsports background, and there's a lot of industries that are dependent on fossil fuels, whether it's natural gas or petroleum, based fuels. For us to attack those industries is literally going to kill millions of jobs right off the bat. And so those stories of those folks that are dependent on these industries have to be told. And that's why, when I'm in Congress, I'm going to continue to fight for those industries and push back against the sort of arbitrary, limits or arbitrary mandates that these environmentalist groups are pushing, because they're not based in reality. The energy grid is not ready for electric cars at the scale that they're proposing. That's just one example. But the second example, and it resonates with people more, is regardless, even if the grid was where it needed to be, why should the government be mandating these things? Shouldn't families be able to decide for themselves what kind of cars they can purchase, or trucks or whatnot? And even further than that, they've been trying to push this electric mandate for 18-wheelers, right? So you're talking about folks that work in the woods, for folks that are on farms, folks that transport goods across the country. You want to talk about a cluster. Let that sort of mandate move forward. You're going to see transportation in our country come to a creeping halt. and it's going to be disastrous for our economy. And that's one of the reasons that Trump's endorsed us, is because we have to start, you know, pushing back against this. And during his administration, hopefully in the future, you know, Congress is going to continue to act and make sure that folks have the choice to purchase what kind of automobiles they want to drive.
You're listening to the Howie Carr Show. I'm Aaron Chadbourne, filling in for Howie, talking to State Representative Austin Terrio from the state of Maine. He's running for the nomination to face Jared Golden. In the 1 minute we have left, Austin, obviously, the district's interesting because it's a district that there were some voters who voted for President Trump and then also voted to send Jared Golden to Congress. What's your message for those voters?
Well, my message is there's always a future opportunity to make sure that you can elect somebody to Congress who's going to have, you know, the best interest of the district in mind. And I think people are starting to realize that Jared is a nice guy. You know, he's somebody I'd love to have a beer with, but at the end of the day, on these important issues, he's not leading the district forward, right? He's sort of there, and he's not a leader. He's not somebody that's moving our economy forward, giving people hope, bringing investment into our communities. And I really think people in this election coming up are going to look at Trump, you know, at the top of the ticket, and myself, you know, running for Congress, somebody who can be a fighter, a very aggressive fighter for the district, because it's about time the district has somebody in Congress who's not going to be afraid to take a stand and fight for the values of our district.
Austin Terrio, thank you for joining us tonight on the Howie Carr Show.
Well, I appreciate it. Folks can go to austinformaine.com if you want to get involved. I'd appreciate it.
All right. We'll be right back after this. 844-500-4242, the number to join us on the Howie Carr Show. I'm Aaron Chadbourne, and this is Howie Carr.
The Howie Carr Show. Howie Carr is back.
We're back on the Howie Carr Show. I'm Aaron Chadbourne. I've been filling in for Howie. He will be back tomorrow, so have no fear. Howie will be here. 844-500-4242, the number if you would like to join the conversation here on the Howie Carr Show. Let's go to the phone lines and talk to David. David, welcome to the Howie Carr Show.
Hey, Aaron, thank you for the call. I'm not a doom and gloomer, but do you think that what is going to help all of these disillusioned young people, a grip of reality, that I'd hate to think that something tragic, you know what I mean? That something, you know, that, you know, they live in this world that everything is, you know, just protest and it's a beautiful, that I would hate to think that something tragic would have to happen for them to wake up, to unify, to, I mean, but I don't want to be a doom and gloomer, but I'm just trying to think what's going to snap them out of this this disillusion that they're in. You know what I mean?
It's interesting, and thanks for the call. I don't know what it is. I think that when people are young, they want something to protest against. I think they need to learn, and I think there need to be consequences. And that's the big thing here. Like, I'm all for people's right to protest. But when you're doing it on private property, when you're interfering with other rights of others, there need to be consequences, and you learn from them, and you either decide to tolerate those consequences or that they're not worth doing. And when you're a university, and this is where I think, by the way, all those university presidents that testified in front of Congress, what they got wrong back when they testified is, first of all, they should have unequivocally said that calling for genocide against the Jewish people or any group of people is abhorrent and against their code of conduct. And then they should have risen to the occasion and said, we are places of learning and we're meant to educate people and develop them into human beings with the capacity to learn and to grow and to do better. And part of that is learning, you know, what is it that you're actually fighting for and standing for? People saying these chants without knowing what they mean or trying to demand it, or those people that, you know, went from one campus to the other and didn't quite know why they were there. It's really, you need to create consequences that allow people to understand what they're actually doing. And that's what we're missing. They're young people. They need to learn. But these universities need to create an environment that teaches them, not just by the in-the-classroom stuff, but by, you know, trial and error. You touch a hot stove and you get burned. And some of these people need to get burned. There need to be consequences. They need to be disrupted. They need to be suspended. They need to have their information shared with employers. All of that, I think, if that's what you're going to do, if you believe in the cause that you're fighting for, you need to see what the consequences of doing that are, what the consequences of your behavior are. People have known that. That's protest culture for forever. And there should be consequences. And hopefully these things don't fold. That caller did remind me, though, a little bit. Did you see James Carville melting down? What's the cut? Cut 17, Taylor.
Get a hold. There will be no government left. There'll be no rights left. You'll live under theocracy. You'll end up Christian nationalism. But that's all right, you little 26-year-old. You don't feel like the election's important to me. They're not addressing the issues that I care about.
See, that's James Carville on the other side blaming young people for not getting out and turning out for Joe Biden. So maybe that is, to the last caller's point, maybe that is the anecdote, though, is that they're disillusioned on that side, too. So what are they looking for? They're looking for leadership. They're looking for leadership. That's what we've had a lack of at our universities. That's what we have a lack of in Congress right now. That's what we have a lack of in Washington. We need to see real leadership that people can look up to and learn from. Before the show, Taylor, we were talking about that quote from Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan wasn't afraid to kind of put out a moral clarity and say, these are our values. This is what we stand for.
Right. This is him in 1969 when he was governor of California, and he was he had to call the National Guard to UC Berkeley for protests that were getting out of hand there. And he ran into some very liberal professors. And this was his response to them, his exchange.
Now, why did you negotiate many times?
Negotiate? What is to negotiate? What is?
University is a public institution.
That's right. But the university,
its own community, and for the community of Berkeley that live around it.
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
I mean, that's where he laid the blame. He laid the blame on the people whose responsibility it was to educate and shape these minds, right? And to help them understand. And that's who you saw it. I think you told me on Twitter you were seeing the professors that were circling the protesters wearing vests, standing between them and the police. That's the environment they've created. They did it on purpose. This is how they've shaped these minds. And we're reaping what they sowed, basically, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And we didn't play the cut, but Joe Scarborough put it pretty well, saying those people that were protesting back then, they're in the faculty now, and they're enabling another generation.
Well, they're your new friends, Joe, so you really did this to us. I'm Aaron Chadbourne. Howie's back tomorrow.